But our topic for this morning, sharing sacred space, egalitarian services at the Kotel. So I start with the origin of Har Habayit. If you're familiar with the classic story of how it was that the Temple Mount was chosen?
The two brothers,
right. The classic story, thousands of years ago, or so they say, two brothers live on either side of a hill. Right? You've heard this story, right? Two brothers live on either side of a hill. One brother is married, has a lot of kids. The other brother lives alone. Each brother has an excellent harvest. And so the brother with a large family says to himself, you know, my lonely brother should at least have wealth. And so he decides that in the middle of the night, he's going to go deposit some of his harvest over on the other side. And the other brother who's alone says, you know, what do I need with all of this? I'm just living alone. My brother has a big family. He has to support a big family. Let me go bring him some of my harvest. And so the two brothers set out from their sides, and in the middle of the night they meet in the middle, and they're surprised to meet each other there, and they realize what's going on. They embrace, and Hashem declares that on the site of their selflessness, that's where the Beis HaMikdash will be built. That's one version of the story. There's a second version of the story. The second version of the story is that the brother with the large family says, you know, my brother has no one to support. He doesn't need all that grain. And the brother who lives alone says, my brother has kids who can go out and work. You know, I need the grain more. And so each one sets out to secretly steal the other one's grain for himself in the middle of the night. And the two meet in the middle, and they fight. And God declares that on that spot, the Knesset will be built. In truth, the story about Har Habayit is actually an Arab story. It's not one of ours. It's an Arab story about how Al-Aqsa came to be selected. The story with the Knesset is my own story. That's on neither side. But the truth of the matter is that we live in an age where the Knesset story could be told about the Kotel. Right? You have this monthly drama of women coming to the wall in talis and tefillin with the Sefer Torah for Rosh Chodesh, and then facing abuse from the people on the other side who show up to counter demonstrate. To use a polite term, you have the complaints coming from those who want to have a service of their own kind, whatever their way is to pray to God at the Kotel, and then they're told, well, you can use a spot on the southern wall, and they don't want a spot that's further south, Robinson's Arch. And it's not just davening, right? You have menorah lightings, you have other ceremonies that go on in the Kotel Plaza. So in the beginning of 2017, the Supreme Court in Israel came up with a ruling. It's found in number one on your sheet from the JTA article on it. Israel's Supreme Court has ruled in favor of women being allowed to read from the Torah in the women's section at the Western Wall and declared that an egalitarian prayer area set aside at nearby Robinson's Arch does not constitute access to the holy site. Robinson's Arch is not good enough. In an interim injunction announced Wednesday, the court gave the wall's Orthodox administrators and state agencies 30 days to show cause why women cannot pray, quote, in accordance with their custom or allow them to pray as they choose. Now, obviously, if you count 30 days from then, you realize that expired a year ago, and it still hasn't happened, because, after all, nothing is simple and nothing is straightforward, and there will be injunctions and arguments and fights back and forth for the foreseeable future. But the question is, fundamentally, what is it that we want? What is it that that we would like to see on that site? What should be happening? Now, for the sake of our discussion, I am going to stipulate that within traditional halacha, as I understand it, an egalitarian service is not acceptable. Okay? I haven't defined what egalitarian even means. You know, does it mean women leading the davening? Does it mean women getting aliyos? Does it mean them counting for a minyan? I'm not going there, because it's not the point. The point is, if there is a black box that contains a type of prayer service which halacha will not approve of, what do you do when a group shows up and says, that's what we want to do at the Kotel? How are we supposed to respond? And you can put in that black box whatever type of service you don't like. It doesn't make a difference. Follow? So we're not, just because we can have a whole shiur, we can have a series of shiur on egalitarian services, l'minehem, all the different varieties, and that would be great, but it wouldn't come close to addressing the question of what do you do when some people want to have this kind of service, and others say, what do you mean? This is counter to halacha. The Kotel, in its origin, in the real story of how it is that we ended up with the Temple Mount, right? Obviously, you know, I should mention, the Kotel is not a wall of the Beis HaMikdash, right, that you're all familiar with. The Kotel is a retaining wall for the Temple Mount. The walls of the Beis HaMikdash, unfortunately, are not currently standing. But in terms of the site and how the site came to be special, when is the first time when Har HaMoriah becomes important?
Okay,
that's Yitzchak, right. That's where Avraham and Yitzchak performed this, remarkable is not the right word for it, but this outsized act of self-sacrifice. Yitzchak being willing to give up his life, Avraham being willing to give up everything he has ever hoped and dreamed for, right? That's when the site becomes special. Then, generation later, Yaakov pledges on that spot we are taught, Kol asher titen li aser asvenu lach, everything that God gives me, I am going to tithe. This is a site that's supposed to be about selflessness. Right? Arab story notwithstanding. This is a site that's supposed to be about selflessness, about saying, I am not going to stand on what I want and what I think should be. I am willing to follow instead the command that I am given, and that's what creates the Kedusha. So what exactly is it that we are supposed to do here? How do we create that Kedusha? What exactly is it that Halacha wants from us? So there are three different tacks that I'd like to take. David, you look perplexed. Okay. So three different tacks that I'd like to take here to show different ways to solve this. And they're all based on different ways to ask the question in the first place. Meaning, your answer for what to do with these services at the Kotel depends on how you frame the question. The first way to frame it is the simplest way to frame it, and it's the way that just intuitively we might look at it. It's a technical approach to the problem. Essentially, it looks at it this way. From the perspective of traditionally observant Jews who are asking this question, I'm not a fan of the word Orthodox. I don't like the word Orthodox for a whole range of reasons that are beyond the scope of this year. So I'm just saying traditionally observant, which is much more clumsy, but that's the way it goes. From this perspective, we're not talking about how you run a country. We're not talking about it as a political issue. I have a traditionally observant shul where Jews have been davening for ages. The site was built by traditional Jews. Traditional Jews sacrificed a great deal to protect it and to take care of it. And I'm not talking about since 1967. I'm talking about since forever. We longed for it. We davened in order to come back to it. We said, we want to see Hashem come back to Tzion. And as a result, when you hit 1967 and we regained control of the site, traditionally observant Jews established again a place to daven there. And for a very long time, and this the following sentence is not going to gain me friends, but I think it's true. For a very long time, non-observant Jews or non-traditionally observant Jews did not view the site of the temple as significant at all. Reform Judaism, from its establishment until 1967, was anti-Zionist. We don't believe in coming back there. Conservative Jews traditionally did not pray for a restoration of the temple. Right, the Sim Shalom Siddur omitted the Karbanot, the parts of davening that talk about what went on in the Beis HaMikdash. So I could look at this and say, this is my shul. It is, call it, an Orthodox shul. And if someone comes to me and says, we would like to establish a new service in your shul, and by the way, it's going to be egalitarian, whatever flavor of that you mean, what Orthodox shul is going to allow that? I mean, imagine your shul, right? If some group came and said, what you guys do is really nice. We'd like to have space here too, and we're going to hold a service of our own. Right? There have been historically cases in which different, you know, synagogues found themselves without a building and they shared space in somebody else's synagogue, but that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is coming in and saying, you do your thing and we're going to do our thing at the, in the building that you built that's been dedicated for what you do. You know, that's what we'd like to do on site. And when you frame the question in that way, I think the answer is fairly straightforward. Right? No. Right? That's going to be the answer. The answer is going to be no. If you take a look at source number two, a letter from Rav Nevenzahl. Rav Nevenzahl, of course, is the Rav of the Old City. He comes to support the position of Rabbi Shmuel Rabinovich, who is Rav HaKotel, the rabbi in charge of what goes on at the Kotel Plaza. So Rav Nevenzahl writes, Basi lechazek es yidei harav agon Shmuel Rabinovich, Rav HaKotel HaMaharavi, haomeid baperetz lishmor amachanenu kadosh, vilochem b'meshach shanim kineged portzei chomad hakedusha. He says, I am here to support the Rav HaKotel Rav Rabinovich, who stands in the breach. He is going to protect our holy camp. He has fought for years against those who would breach the wall of Kedusha, of holiness. Those who wish to desecrate the Western Wall, Israel, with practices that are against the Torah, that are against our tradition. How dare they? He stands in this regard like a reinforced wall. He does not capitulate to their requests. So, all with tvuna and chachma, with understanding and wisdom and commitment to Hashem, commitment to the Torah. Rav Nevenzahl says, no, they can't do this. It's a simple matter of what are you allowed to do, what are you not allowed to do, what does Allah say? That's all. Beginning, middle, and end. Rav Rabinovich is willing, he says, to compromise when he is able. So in source number three, I brought you a piece in which he was quoted regarding a menorah lighting at the Kotel a few years ago, where some of the female ministers of the Knesset wanted to be able to light the menorah. And he said, not in the general ceremony that takes place in the men's section, but you can have menorot in the women's section and you can light there. Unclear to me exactly what the objection was here. Was it that there was a tefillah going on? Was it because it's in the men's section, therefore it must be for men and he doesn't want any blurring of lines? I don't know exactly what it was that was happening such that there should be this objection, but he believed, what I am offering is a compromise in order that everybody should be happy. And he goes on in that article to say, you know, my value is peace. I don't know why no one else's value is peace in this. I'm being the peaceful one. That's his position. That's your first approach to the issue. It's fairly simple and straightforward. The question is it mutter for an Orthodox observant shul to allow this to go on? And the answer is no. Okay. But it's not where it ends, because then this will be a 15-minute shiur. The second approach is to focus instead on the relationship between Jews who observe halacha in different ways. Meaning Jews who observe it the way that I think halacha should be observed, and Jews who observe it in the way that somebody else thinks halacha should be observed. Whatever their something else is. Within this approach, it is a given that that this service is indeed prohibited by halacha. It's a straightforward thing. It's a given. It's understood. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that I need to act on that. That doesn't necessarily mean that I need to prohibit this service. Just because it's usher for them to do it doesn't mean I have to stop them from doing it. You follow? Because this is a classic halachic question in its own right. Instead of the halachic question of who counts for a minyan, or who gets to lane, or who gets to put on tefillin, the halachic question is, if I believe that other Jews are doing something wrong, what is my obligation in that regard? Right? What's the answer? You know that there are halachos associated with this. There are mitzvos, you know, mitzvah oraisa, right? That relate to this. Like what? Source number four. Lo sisna tochicha bilavavecha. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Go tell him. Hocheach tochicha es amisecha. You should, as I translated here, educate. I've been told that educate isn't strong enough, but I think that's the meaning of the words. We use the word tochach, we often translate it as rebuke. But lehochiach is to demonstrate that something is correct.
True, right.
Yeah. So, prove doesn't work, though, in context. But hocheach tochiach es am yisecha, you shall surely educate your friend robustly. Velosi sal ocheit, and do not bear sin for him by not having done so. That's why I should intervene. In other words, it's not about can I have such a service in my shul. It's about I have to stop them from having such a service in my shul because of the mitzvah of tochacha. It's not only about tochacha, though. There's another level to it, which is this is going on in Eretz Yisrael. And we have a concern in Israel about having such things happen. If you take a look at source number 5, you shall not cause sin in this land. It is an offense to the land of Israel and leads to our being evicted from the land if we allow certain practices to go on. So it's not only the general mitzvah of tochacha, but it's also about making sure that chet does not take place, sin does not take place in Israel.
So then this by also not only the kaiser, but the whole country and this non-traditional minions in general?
Yeah, potentially yes. Koto happens to be an issue because we, you know, view ourselves as the owners.
Right.
But it would happen anywhere. Absolutely. And there are those who will take action against reform, you know, wherever they are in the country and make this argument. There's also another element here, which the truth is could really have been put into the first approach, but I put it into the second. But the truth is maybe I should have put it into the first approach. And that is fear that if you're really going to allow the other in this story to do what they want, it's going to prevent me from doing what I want. Rav Nevensaal, in that same piece that I quoted in number 2, pointed this out. Meaning, the logical extension of the Supreme Court's ruling doesn't stop with there can be an egalitarian service in part of the Kotel. Because inevitably, there will be 10 other groups that want to do their own thing. And they're going to want their own sections. Or they're going to go to my section? Like, I don't know how exactly this is going to work, but you're going to have a whole bunch of different groups that want to do their own thing. You'll have an interfaith group that says, well, we want to do our thing.
Is it like a slippery slope fallacy?
Oh, I'm not even talking about it. Slippery slope would be saying, therefore it's us. I'm not even at that point. I'm just saying, you have to recognize that your decision to say everyone has access means everyone has access. Or, to put it a little differently, it's not a slippery slope, it's a cliff. It's binary. Either it's done this way, or it's done every way. There's no logical reason to draw any lines. Because if you're going to go based on history and say what it was historically, then it's all going to be one way. And if you're going to throw history out, then it's going to be every way. Where is your reason, or where is your basis for distinguishing one from another? So that, the sort of Nevensaal says, you know, we may not be able to daven at the wall. That's what could happen. At a certain point, you create an environment in which there's no room for a traditional halachic observance at the Kotel. That's really, you know, a potential result. And lest you say it could never happen, recognize this happens all the time. I gave you a Muslim case in source number 6, just because this was so fascinating when this happened a year ago. Muslim girls must swim with boys in Switzerland. Did you hear about this? A Muslim family in Switzerland. The girls, as part of their school, have a phys ed requirement, and they are required to swim. And it's a co-ed swim. And the parents didn't want their girls to do a co-ed swim. They were willing to take them to swim single sex, not co-ed. The couple was not allowed to do so. And here you see, the couple then lodged their case with the ECHR, European Convention on Human Rights, or Court for Human Rights, alleging that the requirement to send their daughters to mixed swimming lessons violated Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights. The ECHR unanimously threw out their complaint, finding there had been no violation of freedom of religion, and that Switzerland's right to facilitate successful social integration according to local customs and mores, took precedence over parents' wish to refuse. Sorry, it's the way it goes. And you'll say, well, that's unique. No, it's not. Happened here in Canada last week. I gave you a source, source number 7. Divisional Court. The Christian Medical and Dental Society of Canada v. College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. You're all familiar with the issue of medical assistance in dying, right? Assisted suicide. The doctors are not only eligible to help a patient die, but obligated to help a patient die. It is a violation of their human rights, assuming they qualify for assistance in dying. It's a violation of their human rights not to provide it. That's the rule.
That just means referring to a colleague, practically.
So they said, we're going to be nice, and we're not going to force you to kill people. What we will instead say is, you have to refer the patient to somebody else who will kill them. So the doctors, many of them, said, well, that's actually not allowed by our religion either. And the response of the court was very interesting. The Ontario Medical Association said, nah, your religion doesn't require that. That was the response of the Ontario Medical Association. The court didn't say that. The court said, we understand your concern. Too bad. Take a look at source number 7 from the ruling. This is hot off the presses. I therefore conclude, says the judge, that the limit on objecting religious physicians imposed by the effective referral requirements of the policies has been demonstrated to be justified under Section 1 of the Charter. The goal of ensuring access to health care, or death care, as the case may be, in particular equitable access to health care, is pressing and substantial. The effective referral requirements of the policies are rationally connected to the goal. The requirements impair the individual applicant's right of freedom of religious freedom as little as reasonably possible in order to achieve the goal. The alternatives proposed by the applicants would compromise the goal of ensuring access to health care in many situations, often involving vulnerable members of our society at the time of requesting medical services. Finally, the requirements are proportionate in terms of effects. The positive effects associated with the effective referral requirements of the policies are significant, while the impact on the individual applicants, meaning those who don't want to do this, those who don't want to refer, while not trivial, does not extend to deprivation of the ability to practice medicine in Ontario, although it may require an accommodation on their part. Now, I am very sympathetic to people who actually want medical assistance in dying. Meaning, and knowing what the cases are, I feel terrible for people who are in that position. But what you're telling me now is, if you want to practice medicine, you're going to be required to do this referral, even if your religion says no. That's where things like this go. And there are numerous cases like this. I mean, there's a limit to how many people and how many groups I want to offend by bringing cases about this. You know the case of the bakery in the U.S., right? Facing the lawsuits because they wouldn't provide a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Right? Same issue. It's not about letting somebody do what they want. It's about those who oppose potentially being compelled to go along with it and be party in some way to it. Another one, in number 8, you're familiar with this business with the Canada Summer Jobs Program? Also working its way through the courts right now. There is a grant from the federal government that allows nonprofits to be able to offer summer jobs to people and to get a grant to help subsidize the summer jobs. Sorry?
I did one of these couple of them.
Okay. Well, starting this year, any organization that wants to qualify for this grant has to sign an affidavit that says that they approve of full access to abortion. It doesn't matter what the job is to do. It doesn't matter who they're employing. That's just a litmus test in order to qualify for this grant. It's right here. The concern arises out of the Canada Summer Jobs Program, which this year comes with a new attestation box that all applicants must check off before submitting. The wording of the attestation, which many still find confusing, seems to require a declaration that the applicant does not advocate an anti-abortion position. This article was when a whole bunch of religious groups got together to try to figure out what they could do. They tried to file an injunction to get this held off for a year while they appeal, because the deadline for it is the beginning of February, and the court said no. The court said they rejected the injunction. The case is still going to proceed through the courts, but they're out of luck this year. If you're not willing to check that box, then you can't qualify for the program. So this is a major concern, right? Going back again to how we're framing this question, this is our second approach. Our second approach is, it's not about whether I can allow such a service. The question fundamentally is the relationship between traditionally observant Jews and other Jews, and what's going to happen if I allow or don't allow. So far we have three reasons not to allow, right? Reason number one is tochacha, rebuke. Reason number two is I have a general responsibility to guard what happens in the land, Kotel and beyond. And number three is what's going to happen to my ability to do what I think is important. However, once this relationship is the focus, I can also look at the broader picture than the immediate case at hand and ask whether there are things I can do to strengthen this relationship. And there's a variety of arguments in this regard that says that fundamentally it's about the relationship and about strengthening the relationship between these groups. Now I'm gonna go from the most positive position to the most realistic position in looking at this. The first view is found in source number 9. Actually, I wonder why I put him first on the source sheet. I changed it in my notes. All right, so scramble where we are on the source sheet. Look at number 11 first. I think I meant to move things around, and I didn't do so. The Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, the Nevuchei HaTkufa, he says, "Eineni ma'amin klal uklal she'elahim bilti ma'aminim." In a case that he's dealing with, which is not the same as our discussion, but he says the people who he is discussing, I don't believe at all that they are non-believers. Nira yoser adavar shehem atzivuim bazeh ufihem b'libam einam shavim. He says, I think they are literally dyed, D-Y-E-D. Tzivua is hypocritical. I don't think that their hearts and their words are on the same page. U'mesirusam la'eretz Yisrael shemagi'a le'itim lefanatiyut kitzonit. Doesn't the fact that they have such commitment to the land of Israel, bordering on the fanatical, doesn't that demonstrate that they have great sparks of holiness in their hearts? In other words, these are good people. They have a love of Israel. They have Kedusha in them, and you have to treat them as such. Don't treat them as heretical. That's the most positive formulation of this. A step down in that is the Chazon Ish in source number 10. He says, "Bizman ha'elim," at a time when Hashem is not visible. "Shenichresa ha'emuna min dalas ha'am," when faith has been cut off from the impoverished of the nation. "Ein b'maaseh harada geder hapirza, ela hosafa hapirza." He says, if you were to punish them, if you were to punish people who don't observe the way that we think they should, the result would not be that you would fence in the breach. That's not what would happen. What would instead is you would increase the breach. "Shia b'einem k'maaseh hashchasa," would seem like a destructive act. It would look like you were compelling them to do something. In other words, his point is what we collectively tend to term Tinok Shenishba. There may be an argument for a different framework for it, but that's usually the way this is taken. The idea that if God isn't going to perform miracles, and not going to send Nevi'im, and he's not going to make himself visible, you can't blame the people who act differently, the people who don't respect the Torah and the Halacha. So he says you don't look to punish people in this position. Instead, you look to draw them near ba'avotot ahava, with ropes of love. That's a second framework. Not as positive as Rav Amiel, who says, oh, they're holy and kadosh in their hearts, but still, don't blame them for what they're doing. And therefore, maybe we should be looking for some element of compromise in this regard. A third approach, weaker still in terms of the positive aspect of it, but more practical, is Rav Shlomo Zalman, which I have in number 9. We're just going right back up. In number 9, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach dealt with the classic halachic question, the issue of giving food to somebody who you know won't make a bracha on it. Right? This is a question that's been discussed for centuries. You have somebody in your home, you're giving people food, there's somebody there who won't make a bracha, do you give him food knowing he won't make a bracha? Or do you say, that's lifnei iver? I can't do that. I can't hand it to him. So this issue has been approached in different ways over the centuries. Rav Shlomo Zalman offered a fascinating approach. He says, if you don't give him food, you know what you're doing?
What?
You're causing him to hate you. Right? You're causing him to violate a prohibition. Because he's going to say, I came into this guy's house, he's giving everybody food, and he won't give me. Right? You may even be embarrassed. You may be upset. You're going to create enmity for Torah by doing that. And so in Rav Shlomo Zalman's view, what's the halachic reason not to give them food? What's the halachic argument?
Derabanan knows brachos, right? They don't make a bracha.
Well, it's not a derabanan, though. It's a deoraisa. It's lifnei iver. It's for them. It's a derabanan. But it's a lifnei iver deoraisa for me to put them in a position of violating halacha. However, I will also cause them to actively violate an isser, actively so to speak, by hating me and by hating Torah. So I'm violating lifnei iver either way. So, well, not a shevei al tas, because he's saying give them food. But he's saying that you would cause them to violate a worse isser if you don't give them food. That's the argument that Rav Shlomo Zalman brings. Your lifnei iver goes the other way. Take a look at source number 9. It says, "Hareza doma lemisha koteya etzba meraglo shel chaveiro bechdei lahatzilo so bekach mikitiyat kol hayad shelo." He says, like cutting off a person's finger in order to save his hand. So he won't make a bracha, but at least he'll love Jews. He'll love Torah. That's the idea. He says, "Deposhiru de'eno kari mazik elametakein." You're not called a vandal. You're not harming him. Just the opposite. You're helping him. Mitzvah udekaavid velo avera. It's a mitzvah that you're doing by preventing this michshol, by preventing this stumbling block. So that's an argument again that can be brought to bear in our situation. If you block them from being able to daven at the kotel, you cause greater enmity. But the best formulation, and certainly the most realistic that I've seen, is from Rav Chaim David Alevi. You take a look at source number 12. Rav Chaim David Alevi deals with the phenomenon known as religious legislation. Laws about buses running on Shabbos, laws about restaurants not serving chametz on Pesach, things like that. And it's a long quote, but I felt it was worthwhile, and that's why I brought it, despite its length. That, and I can cut and paste it. He says, "We have a strong desire to give our state a religious character, where the Torah of Israel will be its law, though none of us believe that we will succeed, at least not in this generation." He says this in the 1950s. "But does anybody think that we will achieve this by way of party tactics and parliamentary politics based on coalition promises having the nature of watch out for me and I will watch out for you, give me and I will give you? Obviously, this approach as well should not be totally rejected, but this is not the way of the Torah and is not the way we will succeed. Even coalition promises have certain limits, and we will never be able to force our views and beliefs on the entire country by way of the law. We will certainly succeed in passing a larger number of laws that will guarantee the Jewish nature of the state, but will this suffice to guarantee their fulfillment? Say he won't take the bus, he'll drive. Yishkoach, what did you accomplish? He won't buy trafe in the restaurant. He'll serve it in his own house. Like, what have you done? You haven't brought anybody to Torah. How can we impact upon beliefs and opinions with the help of statutes? Moreover, besides the nice impression that a religious law makes on the book of statutes, what is the concrete benefit as long as it is not implanted in the conscience and belief of the heart?" We do the whole quote. It's worthwhile to read at some point. But in the interest of volume, I'm going to skip the rest here. But he doesn't like the idea. He says that you're not really accomplishing anything. And so that's a second approach here at the wall. If you're going to say, at the wall, you have to daven my way, number one, go back to Rav Amiel. You may be squelching people who have some kedusha in them. Taking the view of the Chazon Ish, you're harming people who may be separate from Torah as Tinok Shenishba. You may be violating Lifnei'iver when you think that you're fulfilling it. And, per Chaim David HaLevi, you're not even accomplishing what you think you're accomplishing. Oh, so now they won't have an egalitarian service in the Kotel. So they can do the egalitarian service somewhere else. And therefore what? What have you accomplished? So that's a second school of thought. You follow? The service is awesome, but it doesn't mean that I'm serving halacha by banning it. Third approach takes an entirely different perspective. This approach, again, assumes that the egalitarian service is awesome, is prohibited. But it asks whether a Jewish state has other goals to consider when it comes to legislating religion. And we know the state has other concerns. Right? Concern number one is survival. Rav Yitzchak HaLevi Herzog, the second chief rabbi, in source number 13, asks the question regarding not Jews and Jews, but Jews and non-Jews. You know, the Torah talks about not having avodah zarah in the land. So tell me something. How many churches are there in Yerushalayim? Right? Leave aside the question of what Islam is. But how many churches do you have in the land? How are you not going to war to prevent all the churches from being in the land? So there are a variety of arguments in this regard. I'm not litigating that question right now. Yitzchak HaLevi Herzog in source number 13 says, good luck, writing in the 50s, take a look at source number 13. The article in Tchumen is after he dealt with this. He dealt with this in the 50s, but the article in Tchumen is in the 70s, is when it's published. He says, Ma aleinu lasot? He says, what exactly are you proposing that we do? La'gid la'umot, ein anachnu yecholim lekabel at ha'tnai hazeh. To say to the nations, we cannot accept this condition that there should be churches in our land. To say our sacred Torah prohibits a Jewish government from allowing Christians to live in our land, from allowing idolaters to live in our land. And the Torah prohibits us from allowing their worship in our land, and it won't allow us to have them buy land. He says, "Dumani shelo yimotzei rav b'Yisrael bal moach ubal seichel yashar sheyisbor shealenu la'ashiv kach." He says, "You're not going to find a rabbi in Israel with a brain in his head who thinks that that's a good idea. To think that that's what the Torah is obligating us to do." And afilim naniach. And he says, even if you believe that we're breaking halacha by allowing this, I would still say violate it, because otherwise we won't survive. So his position is survival of the state is a great value. Now, I'm not saying that that's the same as what's going on at the Kotel. I'm not saying the state won't survive or Jewish people will die as a result of this, but I'm showing you the acceptance of a meta value in the name of the existence of the state. That's the idea. And the same position could be taken, not only in terms of that value, but in terms of the value of having a unified Medina, a state in which everybody is going to get along on some level. Take a look at source number 14, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cook, because you can't address this topic without mentioning Rav Cook. He says, Ein keitz l'ra'ot ha'gashmiyot v'aruchaniyot shel hitbardut ha'umal ha'chalakim. There is no end to the material and spiritual ills involved when you split the nation in two segments. Af al pi sheperud gamur ke'oleh alev ha'menatkim b'achzariyot i'afsharu v'hayo lo yiyeh. He says, granted that, it'll never happen anyway. It's impossible to divide the Jewish people. But his point is, you can't separate us. You can't split us into segments. Now, what I did not say is the following. If we're not supposed to divide into segments, what are your choices? Right. You have two choices. Either say, everybody does what they want, or say, no, it's all going to be the way we've been doing it all along. Reverend took the latter view. took the opposite view in source number 15. This goes back to the early days of the state, and there's a debate going on. When you have religious soldiers serving in the IDF, should you have separate units for them? Or should everybody serve together in one big mishmash? The religious parties said, religious units. Let them be apart. They'll do their thing. They'll have kosher food. They'll have different duties on Shabbos. And everybody else will do whatever they want to do. The non-religious, or anti, perhaps, in certain circles, parties said, that's exactly what we want. You guys do your thing over there, and we don't have to see you. In Rav Gorin's biography, one of them is quoted as saying, let them eat cholent all day. We don't want to see them. We don't want to know from them. They'll have their shuls, and they'll have their davening, and they'll have their food, and that's their business. And Rav Gorin said no. He said, that's a mistake. Look what he said in number 15. I asked the meeting's participants, what would be the ramifications of the religious soldiers being segregated in religious units? The result would be that the entire army wouldn't observe religious precepts, would not eat kosher food, would not observe Shabbat and holidays, would not have any synagogues. Only the few special units that would be defined as religious would have kosher food and observe Shabbat. Now that we had won the right to establish our own state and had created the IDF, we had the right to demand that the entire army behave like a Jewish army. Everybody keeps Shabbos, everybody keeps kosher. That was Rav Gorin's approach to the problem. Now, mind you, Rav Gorin also would then go to the nth degree to try to be lenient in his definition of what a Jewish army looks like. So he would try to find leniencies where he could to make this something that would be doable and would not alienate everybody. So, for example, you know, one of the issues that has come up in recent years in the army is Heder Mechira during Shemitah. What do you do when not everybody is willing to rely on Heder Mechira, but they're serving in your Nachal Haredi? Because the army now buys produce from Jordan to satisfy the Haredi soldier. Do you do it for the entire military? Because everybody's going to have the same standard, and you're all going to order the same thing. This is a real life issue. It happened in the last Shemitah cycle. There were articles about this at the time in the media. Can you believe that that's what the IDF is going to do? I don't remember what they did in the end. But Rav Gorin's statement is, fundamentally, the state has to value having one nation, not everybody being separate, and therefore, everybody has to do the halachic way. And that's what he would have done, I think, at the Kotel. One way, and just be as accommodating as halachically possible in that one way. I think he would have done the same thing with that, with the Kotel, as he did with the IDF. This argument is made today by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin and Rabbi Benny Lapp. Take a look at source number 16. Rabbi Riskin's position in an interview. He says, Hayahadut bichlal, Judaism in general, v'akotel ha'maravi bifrat, and the Western Wall specifically, kol kach yikarim, kol kach hashuvim, they are so precious, they are so important. U'biltiyev sharish, anachnu nashir et ha'atid ha'yahadut rak liyudim ortodoxim. He says, you can't leave the future of Judaism to Orthodox Jews. That's what you're going to be telling all those people when you say they can't pray their way at the Kotel. You're telling them Judaism is not for you. That's his argument. He says, Hashem has sabrit im klal Yisrael. God made a covenant with all Jews. Im kol Yehudi ba'asher husham, with each Jew as he is. V'anachnu mukhrachim la'achil kol Yehudi gam betoch ha'yadud. We have to find a place for every Jew in Judaism. V'gam b'efshur la'geshet l'talel l'yad ha'kotel ha'maravi, including to be able to daven at the Kotel. I don't want them to be alienated from that which is fundamentally the primary religious site that we have as Jews. Take a look at number 17, please. Rabbi Lau, Rav of the Ramban Shul. He says, Lo k'day l'nasodu l'hashivat ha'kfitz l'mekomo. You can't press the spring back in. Meaning the spring being this division of Jews into all their different groups. Zelo yitzvach, zelo yoil. It ain't gonna work. K'day l'hafik l'kachim l'mekomo. He says what we should do is draw lessons from this incident, this whole business, because this is a long road ahead. We have to be one, and everybody's got to have their place. And that's his argument. So we see three different approaches. One approach asks the question of usur or mutter, this service. Can I let it happen in my shul or not? Second approach says, do I have an obligation to prevent it from happening in my shul? Or do I have an obligation to try to unify everybody? Not unify, unity is really the third point, but a duty to try to bring them close, to see value in what they do, not to drive them off. And then the third approach is to say, you know what, it may be wrong. It may even be lifnei iver. It may be a violation of tochacha, but maybe there's a more important value in making sure that they have access to the wall, in making sure that we are one nation, or not. Or the value of unity is, make them do it my way, and just be as accommodating as possible within my way, but make sure that we will be one. All these different ways that you can address the problem. Last note on this. This is a classic Dvar Torah, you've probably heard it before, from Elevation. There are two principal mountains within Judaism, and I don't mean Har Grisim, Har Eibal. There are two principal mountains within Judaism. What are they? Har Sinai and Har Moriah, side of the Beis HaMikdash. After Matan Torah, what is the status of Har Sinai? Nothing. Shofar blows, everybody can climb up the mountain, and now we don't even know where it is. Right? Har Sinai loses its status. Beis HaMikdash, Har Moriah, according to the Rambam, Hashem remains there always. Says Rav Soloveitchik, as quoted by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in the quote in source number 18. Harav Soloveitchik kotev shebahar Sinai, that at Har Sinai, Heref on the Oran is Gav. Umaleak Nimshash Yidrachesh Bo, despite the lofty and entirely holy event that took place there, Ein Hayom Shum Kedusha, Ve'ab Ein Yadua Mikumo. There's no Kedusha there anymore. We don't even know where it is. Whereas the Beis HaMikdash, that remains holy. Why? End of the quote. Bo Nisaha Adam Litkarev LaKadosh Baruch Hu V'lo LaHefem. Because that's where we try to get close to God. We invested it with Kedusha. We were the ones who said, let us sacrifice there. Going back to Avram and Yitzchak, going back to Yaakov. We were the ones who invested that site with its holiness, and that's why it remains. And so whichever approach we're going to take to what to do with the Kotel, it has to come with that as a starting point. The starting point is, how can I invest it with Kedusha? Whichever way I look at it, whether I'm taking the first approach, what is the halachic status of this minyan in my shul? The second approach of what's my duty to other Jews who want to do that? Or the third approach, what am I doing here globally, my meta values as a state? Fundamentally, it all has to be driven by the desire to invest in the Kotel and all Israel, really, with a Kedusha that endures forever.